as the most populous country in the world, China also has the most young adults, around 700 million under the age of 40. Zach Deichwald operates the Young China Group to examine how the expectations of China's millennials and Gen Zers are substantially different from their parents. He's joining us on Travel with Rick Steves by a remote connection from his temporary headquarters in Mexico City. So your work at Young China Group is really designed to help prospective business connections between China and the rest of the world in both directions, I would imagine. In fact, you're in Mexico City right now working on a project to connect Mexican businesses with Chinese businesses. I know you have kind of a survey that you have with your clients, and you have sort of a little cheat sheet that explains cultural factors that you really should be aware of. All of these developments really have an impact on anybody with a business interest in China. What are you finding this is the most important advice you can give somebody that wants to establish a relationship, a business relationship with China these days? It seems like there's an unpredictability that comes in here and a lack of consistency or a volatile new dimension of China that would be bad news for business people.
Well, the last 3 years, that lack of predictability has defined the business environment in China. You know, before 2020, when people would call me, they'd want to know about what are young people thinking, feeling, what do they want for their future? What keeps them up at night? What do they think is sexy? What is, you know, masculine and feminine mean in young China? So how does identity drive economic outcomes? And then the last 3 years, it's all been government. And what's exciting right now and what we feel like we're on the precipice of, once again, is government beginning to take a step back. You know, Davos is happening right now. And from Liu He, which is a senior government official within China, the news that he released at Davos was pretty clear that, hey, China is open for business again. So here's what I would say. I would say regardless of what business you're in, and even regardless of whether or not you're in the business of China, whether or not you're traveling abroad to Southeast Asia or Europe, whether you're in the international movie business, or you're just taking your grandson or granddaughter to see a movie, and wonder why Shanghai is as prominently featured as New York, China is an inevitability to a certain extent. And it will be impacting most every facet of our lives. And what troubles me when I talk with some Americans in particular, and I say this from a perch in Mexico and from doing this project, focusing on US-China competition everywhere but the US and China, is that we think it's really just the US and China, and that competition with China is going to be about excluding the country from entering the United States. And that actually might unfold. There's real regulatory risk here. But what you're seeing in other countries around the world is that Chinese companies are increasingly making products that are more socioeconomically proximate, which is a very fancy way of saying people in China have a lot in common with people in Mexico in terms of what they need, how they use technology, how they access the internet, how they access credit, how they access debt. They have a lot in common with people in Indonesia, throughout Southeast Asia, throughout India. And so there's this question of how do you make what the rest of the world wants? And there's an argument within China right now that if the government starts to take a back seat and allows a more predictable economic environment, many of these Chinese companies can be quite competitive, maybe not in the United States, but in the 180, 190 other countries around the world. There could be a very large appetite for
that.
That
is very interesting because my whole understanding, I'm a good capitalist, you know, my whole thing is find a need and fill it. And I know what people want, but my world is America. And America is quite unusual on this planet. China is a global thing. And I've seen the impact of China in Africa, for example. I've seen emerging economies where everybody has a car, but it's a different kind of car than what I think you'd have. What would you say in a nutshell is that from a Chinese point of view, I guess, the difference between the material appetite of the United States, which is 300 million wealthy people, and the material appetite of India, which is a billion people with a middle class as big as our entire population, I suppose, or Mexico or Indonesia, which has the same population as the United States, but obviously catching up with us economically and not as affluent. What do Americans not understand about the material appetite of the other 96% of humanity?
It's value driven. And I can give you a really concrete example. So there's a great company in the United States right now who's trying to reinvent the EV market No, it's not a certain eccentric Twitter CEO. It's this company called Rivian, who makes these beautiful, incredible electric vehicles, pickups, and they're gorgeous. They're incredibly high powered. They're about 90 grand. My favorite Chinese EV company right now, and there are some high level competitors with companies like Rivian and Tesla, but it's a company called Wuling Xiaoche. And it's a $5,000 electric vehicle that for an Asian megacity is perfect. It's small, it has limited range, but it's all that you need to commute and park in these 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 20 million person cities. And that car, and then the equivalent of that, so that phone or that payment option or that approach to the mobile internet that's coming out of China is a far better fit for places that are more socioeconomically similar to China versus the US, which is we're pretty unique in that we're all pretty well off and you know, we have to work a lot of jobs to feel middle class. But in reality, China is what's called the world's middle class. They have a per capita GDP just over 10 grand, which is almost the same as Mexico and far more similar to Brazil, Peru, Colombia, other Latin American countries, and of course, Southeast Asian countries than, you know, the problems that people are trying to solve in San Francisco. And
so this is a fundamental awareness that an American company that wants to interact efficiently and effectively with the global market, that's a shortcoming on our point, because our global view is an American market, which is absolutely small compared to the potential. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Zach Dykewald, and he is in Mexico City right now, working on a project where he's connecting Mexican businesses with Chinese businesses. Zach, that's an interesting tie-in with what we were just talking about. As you mentioned, the middle class from a global point of view is countries like Mexico, where the per capita income is probably, a sixth or a seventh of the United States. What are you doing in Mexico City and what do you hope to accomplish?
So the first part of this project is just to understand. It came from this idea of working on understanding how Chinese companies go global and also how US-China competition unfolds everywhere that's not the US and China. And Mexico is a really interesting starting point because from a consumer perspective, again, they're quite socioeconomically proximate to folks in China. But Mexico is so aligned to the United States, not just economically with NAFTA, but also in terms of security concerns. I mean, it's your next door neighbor. And one of the really interesting findings, and I've been interviewing a number of Chinese businesses, economists, and manufacturers here in Mexico, is that China and Mexico used to be competitive. They both used to make intermediate goods. They were sort of at the same level in the value chain. But now, since COVID and the major global supply chain crisis, as well as a number of onerous regulatory shifts towards China from the United States, what you're starting to see now is Mexico and China, instead of being competitors, they're collaborators. Hmm. You're seeing Chinese manufacturers investing in Mexican manufacturers so they could sell into the United States. And Mexico is going to be a major beneficiary of the nearshoring, friendshoring theme that's really defined the COVID era as people are trying to figure out, okay, where are we going to make stuff now? And China, they don't want to be blocked out of the US. It's still the biggest, you know, it's still the biggest marketplace in the world. So they're sort of finding ways to sneak into Mexico and other places to try to earn the dollar as business becomes harder.
So as China struggles to fine-tune its approach to the world and the global economy and the demographic changes and all of that, we're also dealing with a different reality in China as it comes out of COVID. What is the post-COVID kind of reality for the younger generation now? How has that changed their take on life and their aspirations?
So it's a little bit like post-financial crisis US. Before the financial crisis, you know, everyone was pie in the sky. I'm going to go to college. I'm going to get a great job. The things that I do will deliver pretty predictable results. COVID has had a similar effect on this young generation in that all of the optimism that was felt for the decade leading up to 2020 has had a major damper put on it. And the job market is not nearly as frothy as it was before. Mm-hmm. And tech companies, instead of hiring, are laying off. And you actually have 20% youth unemployment right now in China, which is brutally bad. And so this young generation has become far more pragmatic. They've become far more measured in their optimism. They still have confidence in the government to find a route and navigate these issues that have come up through really 9 months of kind of rogue wave problems with COVID and of course with Russia and lockdowns being pretty heinously mismanaged. But the optimism that was felt pre-COVID, there's a major asterisk next to it now. So I would be expecting a huge amount of messaging on not just economy. Like when we look at China from the outside, we think about the economy, right? Because that's how it impacts us. That's how it impacts the stock market, whatever. In China, the verbiage is far more about jobs. How do we create good jobs for young people so that that sense of optimism and hope can return?
Zach Dykwald is the author of Young China, How the Restless Generation Will Change Their Country and the World. He's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves before getting back to China for the first time since the pandemic. Hey, Zach, I want to finish by talking about travel. I know when I was in Europe, checking the post-COVID sort of economics and tourism industry, the big thing is tourism is back except for China. I think China's coming out of COVID now a little later than other countries. But boy, when China has a trend, when you talk about 1.4 billion people, that can inundate tourism in different parts of the world. What's going on with travel in China right now, and what do you see in the near future?
So before COVID, I did a lot of work with the travel community, both in the United States and Europe and even Southeast Asia. And so the headline is this. For me, it's much less a question of what, which is an enormous Chinese outbound travel boom, and really a question of when. We have the first testing of China's new outbound COVID policies right now. There's a certain sort of half open, half not in terms of what the Chinese outbound traveler can do. But domestically within China, you have domestic travel for Chinese New Year at about 90% of what it was pre-COVID, which is pretty good. So I got a number for you, Rick. In 2019, China was the largest outbound tourism spender in the world. Number one, surpassed the United States. Only 10% of the population had a passport, 10%, compared to 40% in the United States and 90%+ in most of Europe. That 10% was expected to double by 2025. Now that number is like 2027, 28, which means another 140 million people hitting the road.
Well, you know, if 10% of China has a passport, that's probably twice as many as Americans who have a passport.
10% of China having a passport is almost two times the population of Germany.
There you go. So we've got a huge potential of influx in tourism, which is something that societies all over the planet, I think, are salivating on, because that's a lot of money, a lot of employment. And it all depends on how able and eager the people in China are to get out and use their passports.
No doubt about it. And, you know, when you're closed down for 3 years, what matters kind of rises to the surface. And sure, luxury spending is cool. And yes, eating out is important, really important in China. The want to travel and see the world has been one of the most persistent and really dogged passions that people have within China. I think it's part of what I love about China, honestly, is that people really do want to be exposed to different ideas, cultures, feelings, tastes, smells, cities, what have you. And so I really expect about midway through this next year, we're going to be back in business again. And it's a mixed blessing, by the way. It's a disruptive force for good and with some challenges, which is where a lot of the work I was doing in tourism came from. But it certainly is a great opportunity for these small economies.
I would imagine it's more and more a requirement of an authoritarian government to allow their people to travel in order for that government to stay in power. I know in recent years, the Russians will say the reason they favor and support Putin was because under Putin, they could travel. And they really valued that even more than some other freedoms. And I think China's going to be reckoning with that appetite that people have, especially in this global age when everybody sees everybody at the World Cup or everybody can see everybody on social media. And there is that appetite to get out. Zach, it is so great to catch up with you. I would like just to close it off by asking, if I was a businessman coming to you for advice, should I engage with China? What's your take on China's future today compared with the take you would have had the last time we talked a few years ago? How has it changed?
Today, you have to have a stronger sense of the regulatory pressures in China than you probably felt in 2019, 2018. So to me, the size of China's market, the scale of its global impact in travel and luxury and a number of different markets means that you have to be involved in China to a certain extent. Because over the next decade, not only are you thinking about the Chinese market, but you're also thinking about Chinese competitors these businesses who are growing strong within China and will be going global. So I think there has to be involvement. And now it's less of that pie in the sky, unadulterated optimism that really persisted in the 2010s. Now it takes smarts, it takes the ability to navigate and a more measured approach to untapping that market and competing on the world stage with increasingly strong Chinese competitors.
And I know it's a kind of almost a ridiculous question because there's no way to know, but everybody must be wondering, how long will the authoritarian government in China be able to maintain this lock that they have on what will soon be nearly 1.5 billion people? In the short term, in the midterm, in the long term, is it going to be status quo when you get right down to it? Or do you think there's a big change coming when it comes to freedom in China?
I don't expect there's a big change coming. And this is usually my most disappointing answer to American listeners. The thing I would leave you with is it's not enough for the system in China to be dysfunctional. There has to be a high-functioning, enviable alternative. And that part's important. And particularly for people within China, when they look out at the world, there isn't a system, and this comes with a grain of salt, of course, that they think they would prefer and can deliver more hope, more optimism, more growth, more jobs than the system they currently have at this particular juncture. A couple of years from now, we can check back in and see how this holds.
Well, they're looking out at the world, but they've also got a long history, a long heritage, and I would think that has a lot to do with their inertia. I love the way you refer to different wise phrases from ancient Chinese lore. Is there one sort of phrase that seems appropriate to you now when you sort out the complicated world of China as it relates to the rest of the world?
There's two that come to mind. The first is "Yuan Suan Bu Ru Qian Suan," which means that the official translation I think is "Man plans, God laughs." Basically, all of our plans these last few years, and all of China's plans, by the way, there's no country or there's no government that has had their plans more confounded than China in a lot of ways. And the other one is from Deng Xiaoping, allegedly, in the early 1990s, which is 摸着石头过河. It means crossing the river by feeling the stones, which is a beautiful way of saying that we don't really know how we're navigating this thing. We're feeling the earth and the options underfoot as we go. We're expecting to have to adapt, adjust as we navigate the turbulent waters of time and history and modernity. But we do have a sense of where the destination is, which is getting across that river towards a more prosperous nation, a more stable nation, with a better life for ourselves and our families.
Wow. Those are so great. Man plans, God laughs. I think we can all tuck that away and read it every once in a while. Zach Dykewald, thank you so much. Best wishes with your work with Young China Group, and let's talk again soon. And congratulations on what sounds like a wonderful, wonderful new beginning you have in your life with your wife, your COVID partner, and now you're going back to Chengdu and establish yourself better with a partner in China.
I'm looking forward to it, Rick. Thanks so much for having me. As always, it's always been a blast.
Take care.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazimara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. There's more at ricksteves.com/radio.